We'll figure it out.
Okay. Let's call this workshop to order. This workshop is for the council to gather information, and hopefully Ken's laptop will get running here. Roll call, Mark Spohr will not be here tonight, and we will not be voting on anything on the agenda or anything like that, so. Second quarter report from Adams County Fire District 5, Chief Lubachin.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Second quarter was relatively aligned for fires. I believe we had 29 fire incidents in the quarter alone, 51 year to date, which is just up a little bit from last year. Two additional calls from last year. So we're still on target as far as fire volume and no significant events for the city. Had a couple of firefighters attend the Wenatchee Firefighter Conference up there for some additional training, and picked up some new techniques for interior fire attack, and we had two attend a auto extrication class in Arrowhead Heights. With all the new manufacturers of hybrids and all the new technologies coming out in cars, they're making the cars safer for the occupant, more hazardous for the rescuer to go into the car. We've got high tensile steel in the doors now that most tools won't cut. We've got airbags. You can have over a dozen airbags in some of the high-end cars. Those being curtain bags, knee bags, etc. You know, the standard airbag that we all are common and know about is the steering wheel and the passenger bag. They're hit all over the cars now. We have pre-tensioners, which is an explosive in the seatbelt that retracts it, keeps people back. And because of this, we want to stay current on extrication and keep firefighters safe when we do go to an accident scene, so we don't cut into the wrong item and deploy a bag, hurt one of our firefighters or a victim that's already in the car. So we sent a couple people up to that. We're always looking for more training, specialized training. Some different things coming up later this fall, I hope we can get people to. And if we do, we'll inform you about that at our next report. The business inspections, Tom's got 77 done here to date, and he's right on track with those. No big significant problems there as normal. We've had six trainings and then one outside training, which we brought an instructor in to do a first aid CPR class for our own people. The our summertime projects are right on track. We're doing hose testing, which is a pressurizing for fire hoses, full mount equipment, pressurize them up to 250 pounds and hold them for 5 minutes. Leave the pressure back off, drying and restock the engines. We do it, every hose is tested. What we want to see is every 2 years. That's our goal, is every 2 years the hose has gone through and tested. That's part of our summertime project. The other thing we're doing, our pump testing. We do it up on the canal on 14th Avenue. And what that is when a pumper is built at the manufacturer, it's rated. And it's got a UL listing and it's rated NFPA. And you want to maintain that rating for insurance reasons, for our insurance rating. We want to maintain our pumper ratings. So we go up and test them manually. And it takes about an hour and a half to test them, and they're pumping constantly on the canal up there. We've got a site that we can do that with. And fortunately, all the city pumpers and the county pumpers have passed the test this year. No big issues with them. In fact, no issues at all this year. So we were fortunate. The only The city Public Works Department and Fire District will be teaming up again this summer to test hydrants, and that will start tomorrow. We'll start testing and get some of the newer hydrants tested, and hopefully accepted by the city, and then get at least one quad of the city done. Time allows, maybe half the city. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer.
I got a question on, you have quite a few people that are under 18?
We have 12 that we consider cadets.
So they can't go fight the fires now?
They can't actively fight the fire. What we're trying to do is draw a description of the duties that they're capable of and keep within the team labor laws. And we're developing that right now. We're trying to get them involved in rehab. We're trying to get them involved in fire prevention, education, things like that. They're welcome to go on our business fire inspections. I've asked one at a time for that. We're keeping them involved in other ways. And as long as they're keeping their training up, when they turn 18, we just kind of absorb them right in, and they become a full firefighter at that time. But this is something that we're developing right now, the job description. Hopefully we'll have that for them.
We have the budget process coming up in about a month and a half to get started. Anything you guys are going to be requesting, you know of already?
We need lots more.
Yeah. That you're aware of already, or?
No, right now, I don't foresee anything big, but we've got a couple programs we're working on. We're trying to get training, and get specialized trainings, and get some outside instructors in. It's always good to have somebody come out and give us a new perspective. And we've been doing a little bit of it, and I want to be able to do more. It'd be nice to have an instructor, a reporter, come in and give us a new look. And that's one thing we'll be hitting more so next year again. This year we've done a couple outside instructors already. One of the other new programs, our bunker here, which is our attire for structure firefighting. We've adopted a policy or a practice. We're going to replace turnouts. Say, if you had a set of turnouts, you're not going to be in them for more than 10 years. And then they'll be cycled out. So we're buying approximately 5 sets a year to cycle through. And the reasoning behind that is they feel that deterioration due to sun, due to the toxics that we're involved in, the heat, the waters, 10 years is a lifespan, which if you are a very active firefighter, you're probably right, 10 years would be. But if you're not as active, you're not getting as many calls, 10 years is probably a short period of time, or they're not going to be worn out in 10 years, but we're still going to cycle them out. So we're staying within a standard that has been set by NFPA. We're updating our SCBA models annually. We're just trying to get some programs established so we budget for it every year. We know what to expect, and we're going to get there. We can see changes coming, and they're good changes.
Do you have, if the power's out, do you have generators down there?
We have, for the building?
Yeah.
We have one generator in the county station that will actually run half the building and operates the HVAC and the apparatus bay, so we can keep that warm. We can actually operate one office now. Well, with an extension cord, we can power our server so we can continue our day to extension cord to the copper pump.
So do we need another generator for
a city station?
Yeah. I mean, if the power goes out in the winter and say it's out for a week or something, wouldn't that freeze what's in the trucks?
We're going to, if that's the case, and we're without power for a long duration of time, we're going to be looking at providing shelter for others and things like that. We may see those trucks in the city station run to heat the building. You may run the engines for a couple hours at a time, get some heat built up, shut them down, things like that. It would be nice if it had a generator. That would take some doing to put a generator in there. It's always possible. It's probably out of our budget right now to do that, to power that building. But it's something that if the city wanted to look into their options there. And, you know, if the power goes out for a period of time, if we could do that, then we could shelter in that building.
Something I noticed really quick. You guys got a nice new sign this year identifying Adams County Fire District 5 building.
We did.
But we still don't have anything on the city fire department building. I would like to see something on that, identifying that as the Elk Bellow Fire Department building on the front of that.
Put in the budget for next year.
Not a bad idea.
You guys want to. Well, we appreciate all you guys do down there and everything. Yeah.
Some of the council members are doing work here, but the ones that were, when we bought our last city fire truck, there were some conditions on its use. Remember the weight or the volume or something? Is it still under that kind of conditional use, or has that been resolved?
By Washington State bridge laws,
right,
we cannot cross a bridge without truck loading. The city, I don't believe, has a bridge within the city limits. Short of the
open pass.
Overpass. But we can go around that, right, if we were had to. But yes, that's still an issue. And it's a bridge law. We're about 3,000 pounds, if I remember right, over on the GE back axle for bridge. We're not over manufacturers, but we're over, Washington State's got that. It's a bridge law.
Correct.
And it's caught a lot of fire departments.
What about the two canals?
This one up here is a culvert. This one down here is a bridge. But the city's got no property on the other side. And it's not that we're going to go across the bridge and it's going to collapse. There are some bridges in the state of Washington that have a lower weight rating on them. Those are the bridges that we would be concerned about. And there are some county bridges, but they're out of county. And that truck's not going to be used as much in the county. There is a mutual aid agreement, but I don't foresee that being an issue in the county.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming. We appreciate the relationship we have between the city and the county. That's really worked out real well for us. So we look forward to continue working with you guys. So
all right. Well,
thanks,
thank
Chief.
You.
Thanks for coming. Okay. Everybody clicks forward. All right. Informational presentation regarding accessory structures. Daryl?
Thank you, Mayor and Council. Good evening. You may recall at your last meeting, for information purposes, we provided you an example of a draft ordinance that is currently being considered and utilized by other cities in the area that deals specifically with the issue of accessory structures. And accessory structures by Elk Code is defined in residential zones as a structure that's subordinate to the main residence and serves the residential purpose. So garages, tool sheds, any kind of a detached structure from the main residence would fall into the category of accessory structure. And so the council asked to put the issue back onto the this work study so you can have further discussion in regards to that issue. You may recall that the issue has come forward recently through some community discussion as a result of a building permit that was for an accessory structure that was quite large. And so it did raise a few questions at City Hall. A number of residents inquired about it in regards to its purpose, whether or not it was allowed, what the standards are. And so it was at least a good time to say, well, maybe we should look and see if there are things that we want to be doing as a city, and if so, what kind of examples can we bring forward that other cities are currently doing? I think this evening you really have probably two questions to get through in terms of this issue. One is, do we even need to address it? Is the current regulations that we have within our code, which have no restrictions in terms of size of accessory structures, working well for the city of Othello? Has it been abused? Is it an issue in the neighborhoods? And is it a problem that we need to address? And if you identify that it is something that you'd like to address, then you can move on to the second question, which is, how should we do that? And again, we provided that example in form of a draft to the code that sets some limitations on the overall size of the building, the size of lot coverage, for example, that the accessory structure can take, keeping the accessory structure more in scale with the adjoining residents rather than having larger structures than the residential structures that are adjacent to. So those are the kinds of things that we can be looking at in terms of regulating them if you feel in fact there is a need to do that. So the question this evening, I think, is probably going to be a pretty free-form discussion as to whether or not there's a need, and if there is a need, how should we address that? And with that brief presentation, I guess we'll open it up for questions and maybe some council discussion to see if we can answer the first question, is there a need? And if we can answer that question, maybe yes or maybe no. If it's no, we can move on. If it's yes, we can begin to talk about what those specific elements might be.
First question I have is, they play better, okay?
Yeah. Absolutely. It's a structure that's built on 14th that, you know, generates some discussion, is completely in compliance with the existing code. And in fact, I would offer in public testimony that it's probably the nicest garage I've ever seen.
Yeah. It looks sharp.
I agree with 100%. As I was driving on the highway, I was like, wow.
It has a high quality siding. I was told by the owner that the quality of the siding was so good that they were thinking of putting that in their house and replacing their house siding because of that. It first class all the way in terms of this construction. It's fully insulated, it's drywall, it has a heating and cooling system. As a shop, you couldn't ask for a nicer shop.
I just think it's important that we don't change the rules because in the middle of the game, those rules have been in place for a long time.
Yes.
I understand, right? I mean, a few people get upset about it, and, you know, so be it. But everybody's upset about Main Street right now, but when it's all said and done, nobody will remember that.
To me, I don't think we need to be going changing the rules because we have one structure that we're following, and a few people don't like how it looks. We've got a lot of R1 residents out there that have bigger lots that may have the intention. I don't want to change the rules on them all of a sudden and doing that. And, you know, a lot of people's, we've changed our parking lot so much. Some people are building these to park their all their toys in it, their RVs, their boats, their other stuff in it, and I'm not. I just have a problem, like I say, changing the parking, we pushed them off the streets. Now we want to change it where we're going to be pushing them off their own lots. And we're telling them it's hard to tell them what they can and can't build on their own property. And I have a problem with the property rights things starting to bring me fun.
Eventually we're going to run them out of town. They're going to be frustrated and leave. And that's not what we want. We don't want to run people out of town when they're trying, when they are playing by the rules.
Yeah. And also providing a really high quality product.
Yes.
I agree with that. Yes, that proper.
Well, I'm one of the guys that said something about it. There's another one just about two blocks down west of that. And I think it started out as a two-bay, two-story garage and ended up as tall as a two-and-a-half-story house. and three bays and a drive-in on the side. And, you know, if you have a backyard that's backed up to something like that, that's all you can see. It's just a huge thing. It's got windows in it looking right into your backyard. You know, I think, you know, I don't know. It just doesn't seem to me as necessary to have that bigger garage. But I guess if you've got four snowmobiles and four motorcycles and four off-road vehicles and a trailer and a motorhome and all that kind of stuff to put in there, I guess it's reasonable to have one. But we're getting back to the farmer who lives in a two-story shack or two-room shack and builds a 40,000 square foot barn to milk his cows in and keep his hay in. But, you know, so I don't know, but it just seems to me that a garage, my understanding of a garage, you know, you put a couple of cars in it, and that's, you know, it's not something that you can store a semi in. I think you put a 40-foot semi in that thing, you're sure as living. Pretty easy, you know, 13 feet high and 9-foot door, and back right in there. And I'm not sure it's necessary to store that big a thing in a city property in a residential area. But then again, if you got all the toys and stuff, I guess there's a reason for it. But I don't see any reason not to take a look at it anyway. I don't know what other people do.
Got a little bit of a comment here. Nothing out of line, I don't think, because I think it was built according to code and everything. I kind of question that 850 or 900 square feet. Maybe that's stretching that a little bit. That, I guess it's all right, but the only thing I see that we got to watch on a structure like that is, sure, it's fine for this person to use it as such, but as things change and the ownership changes, we got to be sure that they don't change that thing to something commercial in a residential area. And that's one thing with a big building like that, could happen real easy, not even know it's happening. That's the only question I've got as far as a big structure like that.
And as a matter of course, I think as you'll find as we issue occupancy permits for these larger accessory structures, we always identify that they're for residential use only and not for commercial purposes. And that's right on the occupancy permit when that's issued. So that will follow the property, its condition of the permit, and it's something that will be enforceable as long as that building exists. And the zoning does not change to a commercial designation. So we have at least given consideration to the idea that larger buildings are inviting for commercial purposes, perhaps for future owners, and we want to make sure we condition those appropriately so that it's clear on the record for the new property owners that it's not a commercial building.
Is it in our code that buildings like that have to match the house?
No. If that would have been the choice of the property owners, that could have been a similar size building on that siding, for example. In this case, it matches the house very well, and 114. It represents about $100,000 investment on the property owner's part. You're not going to see every property owner wanting to make a $100,000 investment for a large garage. They generally have a need that drives that. You don't build something that large just to have it. So it is something that each individual property owner, I think, has to make a conscious decision as to what the size and what their needs are relative to their current situation.
The reason I asked that is because when I was on the Planning Commission, that was one of the things that we were working on, was like in an R1 zone, you could build a steel-sided building. It had to, you know, kind of match the house. It didn't have to be exactly like it, but.
And it does take you down that path, and I think that's one of the things you probably are thinking tonight in terms of the direction you want to go for the city. It's strictly an aesthetic issue. It's, I guess you could even call it a livability issue for the city. But do you want to begin to regulate and create design standards in the residential districts for the style and color and materials that you put not only on a house but on an accessory structure? And that's a big leap. That changes the character and the attitude of the city in a big way.
to me, that's up for a homeowners association to do that, and that's...
What about what basically looks like a temporary structure, you know, one of those tent-type things? You know, I know where there's one that will hold a motorhome and a couple of cars, and it's pretty big. Is there, you know, what's...
There's two types of structures that are out there that are generally unregulated, and they're considered temporary. One of those is the tarp structure that you buy at Costco, where you put it up on a bay, and it's a bunch of metal poles, and you put a tarp over the top of it, it's anchored down, do some stakes into the ground, and you park your boat or your car or your trailer under that. That's one. The other is the metal buildings that you see, you know, sell on the street corners, different businesses around town, that generally are just a roof with metal posts. Once they put sides on those, and they become something different. But as long as they remain this carport that's you know, portable and they can place on the side or dismantle, those are also considered temporary structures. And at least at the present time, we do not regulate those. Okay. And it's been pretty much the position of the Washington State organization for building officials that it isn't something that jurisdictions want to regulate. Because then once you regulate it, you take on the liability of that building, and as a community, I don't think you want to do that.
Okay.
Right now, the liability for those buildings is on the property.
Now, is there any kind of restriction where when somebody comes with a plan for that, I mean, it's heated and it's cooled and it's plumbed and it's wired, you know, and when you get done wiring it, it's got 220 outlets and all that kind of stuff in it. Where you could pretty basically put a kitchen in there and a bedroom and make a house out of it. Is there any kind of, you know?
Well, the code wouldn't allow that. So once we became aware of that happening, it would be in violation of the code and it would become enforcement action.
Well, I know if I was going to put up a shop, I'd put in 220 so I could have a wall. I'm sure.
Well, I mean, a lot of shops have 220 just because of that, so you can do well in other personal activities.
Okay. So what?
I get you, Greg. I mean, I do. We, you know, on the whole, the size of why do you build it? You know, the answer is because you can. Why do we do a lot of things? Because you can. I mean, Right. Do I think they're going to be putting those up every day? No. No, I mean, who knows what he's going to put in it? But it's his, I guess, as long as he's not running a business out of it and people aren't living in it. He did what he was supposed to. Granted, if it was in the middle of the block, I think I'd have a different opinion of it. But really, the only view he screwed up was his own, so.
Yeah.
But I do see where you're coming from. That's a big structure.
Yeah, it is.
But in regards to a different scenario, if Angel Carter's structure was up front, you know, right in the same line of his house, it'd be no different. Because that garage is just as high.
But it's several in town.
Yeah.
No, I guess if you look at it one way, the guy who sits to the south there at one time had a view up north, now he doesn't have it anymore. Yeah. You know, and it,
of course, one thing to keep in mind is that the city does not have any view ordinance.
No.
There's nothing that suggests that you have to build on your lot in a manner that preserves your neighbor's view. It could have been an extension of his residence that moved over there and blocked the view. And again, it's an interesting path to go down when you start thinking in terms of view preservation and view blocking ordinances. It becomes quite an interesting ordeal once you begin to think in those terms and about that kind of regulation. It becomes very, very restrictive. And at times makes it almost impossible for lots to be developed, especially in a manner in which an individual property owner might want to do that.
The courts in the past have held that views are not protected. The sun is protected. You cannot block somebody's sun, but you can block their view.
And that's mainly because of solar power potential. Back in the 70s, the state adopted a laws that protect solar power capabilities, so you can't block somebody's sun under the site. And if you do through vegetation or other means, you're obligated to remove that if the neighboring property wants access to that sunlight.
So
So I guess the question is, the council want this to come back to, or we pretty much leave it as it is? It looks like. Is that what we're doing?
Pardon? I don't. I'm not sure it's, is it really worth pursuing?
I think our present code pretty well identifies what it is. It's just something that opens up your eyes and all of a sudden there it is, you know?
Yeah.
And it's perfectly legal as far as the code is concerned. I don't really see what you're doing. Like you say, it is a name.
I don't think so. Yeah, I mean, I'm not working.
You might have spent that kind of money on something like that, I don't think.
Okay, well.
Well, I think this discussion has to respond to those people who wish for us to look into this issue. You've had a good open discussion regarding this and we move forward with the existing code and explain that to anyone who would come in and ask in regards to that. But we did have this discussion and I think it serves a very useful purpose to be able to bring this before you and make sure that we're on the right path. So appreciate that.
One more, the thing that I, that might be the easiest thing is the height of the building. So it says in here, you got one in here, it says 18 feet or no higher than the primary structure. Now, I don't, I think the one up there, if you have 13 feet, it gives you enough, you probably get a decent pitch on the roof at that rate. But, you know, it seems like to me 18 feet's tall enough. That would be the only, probably the only restriction I think would be, you know, reasonable. As far as square footage and stuff, I don't think that's.
Well, see, I can see where it would be nice to be, where you're saying no higher than the primary structure, because, for example, where I used to live, it was a block of all one-story houses and a giant two-story garage went up, and it looks odd.
Yeah.
And it looks very odd. And whereas, is if it was a little bit more in line with the primary structure, nobody would have noticed it.
There's a lot of little houses on pretty big lots up on that end of town.
The one over on 14th, it's a big structure, but it really doesn't look that out of place because there's other structures on the block that are big or bigger.
Those are big lots.
Yeah, those are big lots. That's
perfect. So, what are we saying now? Do we want to tweak this a little bit? Is that what we're saying now? Or leave it alone?
I still have a problem with even the height issue because there is a lot of one-story homes. And if a person wants to build a garage for a motorhome, per se, it's going to have to be taller than the one-story home. So you're going to limit them what they could use that garage for.
I mean, that's a tough call, what you're referring to, because I think Roland's house just around the corner. That's a double-sided sword there.
One thing you might find is if you put a height restriction, and I've seen this happen now in other communities, all of a sudden you have this addition to the house that creates a second story, so you can build out that second story and build a much larger garage. So for every rule, there's ways people find to modify their thinking and get around that rule. So, the height is actually one that is more difficult, I think, to expect to be adequately addressed. Other than to talk about scale of the neighborhood, if you wanted to talk about scale of the neighborhood and you had a street of all single-family residences and somebody wanted to put on a second-story addition, then you would have an opportunity to appropriately apply regulations. But if you just simply say you can't build any higher than the house, I think people find a way to get around that. You have to put it more on a community scale rather than an individual lot scale for that to be effective. And then you really, again, begin to develop a whole standard for the community and the town in terms of design standards that, again, leads you down a path of some pretty significant regulation.
It would be really tough to me to see it, especially on any new developments. For example, the Olson ones. There's a lot of combination of single story and two story up there. So if you start to limit the neighborhoods, then he's limited to what he could sell on those particular lots, especially if the family's looking for a larger square foot. And the only way is to go up, especially with some of those smaller lots in the R4 zones.
And that is the trend on smaller lots, is to build a smaller footprint with more vertical square footage. So that's something that you're seeing more and more of. And you'll see more and more of that in remodels in the future, too, I think.
When I had the choice
But you matched yours into your house and things like that. Looks really nice. So.
Thanks to your son-in-law. I don't think this will look right if you back.
Yep.
Okay, well, I guess it sounds like the consensus is leave it alone for now, anyway.
Yeah, we can monitor it, and if it needs to be an ongoing problem, we can come back and have further discussion. But I think that's a good effort in regards to the issue and allows us to move forward and work with people as they come and have a desire to go.
Thank you. I just don't think I thought we were going to see a lot of those. Not right now.
Okay, mail inserts with utility bills policy and procedures. Debbie.
Attached to your agenda program is a draft policy to open up review. And when we went to the new BIAS accounting system, we went to a full page utility bill, and we got a folder stuffer machine that folds and stuffs the utility bill. And it also grabs a return envelope. There's one more slot that we can use to provide information to our citizens. We've taken that opportunity and have provided the CCR report in with our utility bill. And then the Centennial Committee paid for copies of the Centennial Flyer, and we inserted that with the utility bill. So we drafted a policy relevant to what type of insert can be sent out with the utility bills. And this is kind of anticipating that maybe we'll be asked to send out information with our utility bills. The proposal allows inserts submitted by nonprofit and civic organizations and does not allow businesses to submit advertising. It provides that city information will always take precedence over any other submittals, and that submittals will be provided to the city administrator for review. And I think it needs to be to the city by the 20th of November, so in order for us to get the review done, and then they have to pay for the copies to be made. We didn't know what to do about a proposed fee. You can see the justification. We came up with like a $50 proposed fee, which will pay for a portion of the maintenance agreement on the folder stuffer. But that's totally up to the council if they want to consider a fee. So we want to just get council feedback on the proposed policy and direction about whether to allow inserts from other organizations, such as nonprofit organizations or civic groups, and whether or not there should be a fee set if those were to be agreed upon. So there's a couple things to think about is, should we just allow city information only, or allow nonprofits and civic organizations to present things, proposals to the city administrator for review, and should there be a fee? Suggestions?
Actually, we're not supposed to give any services out without a fee, right? That's gifting.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I think we need to charge a fee, a minimum fee,
mm-hmm.
just to cover the cost of the time.
Okay. You saw the justification for the $50, so that's how we came up with that.
I think it's a great idea, too. Because even from Patriot State of Fiesta Amistad to fair, rodeo, that type of stuff.
Oh, and there's a lot of other nonprofits that may want to get information out that they really have no other way of, other than putting something in the newspaper, you really have no other way of reaching people.
Yeah. It is a great idea for people.
I think it's great.
I know it worked pretty good for us in the Centennial. That was one great way that we got it out to at least everybody in town. So, hey, there's no excuse if you didn't have a date. When it was here, I heard a lot of people say, well, gee, we didn't advertise it, whatever. I don't know how else you can advertise it. What we did, besides in each one of those, there was an insert. I would think it would lift everybody in town. So.
And I think as we get used to using this piece of equipment too, that the city will use it more often too, that there will be more information that we can send out with our utility bills too.
So Basically, I think everybody's comfortable with how it's written, correct? That's what I'm seeing here. Yeah, I like it myself, too. And even the $50 fee, I think, is very fair for how many houses it goes into, you know?
I think you're going to find that there's enough nonprofits out there that are going to look to use something like that, that you may really offset your cost for maintenance of the machine.
Yeah. Of course, they'll have to provide us with the copies, the number of copies that we need. And that's what the Centennial, we did too. We made the copies. So if agreed upon, would it be okay for me to put this on the consent agenda also for next meeting?
I got a question for you. In here, if I'm reading this right, it costs $53 to do this, but we only want to charge $50.
No, we just want to round it in.
But it also costs $19.62 for the hourly wage.
Well, I gave you her hourly wage in case there was a question, but then we just use the calculations of the machine, or you know, how many pieces of paper will go through the machine for the year, and we divided that with what the annual maintenance agreement is, and came up with the $53. I gave you the hourly wage for just information. It only takes her about an additional half hour to keep that thing going with an additional page. So
if we did it at 65, that would cover her wage and.
Mm-hmm.
That's
35,
not that bad either.
How many houses do we hit with our utility bill, roughly?
About 1,750
right now. Oh, yeah, there it is. Okay.
Well, some of them are dumb stuff, you know, some of them we put together. We own three or four properties and get one
in. It's pretty inexpensive advertising, really.
Yeah, $65 is way cheaper than putting anything in the newspaper or.
Way cheaper.
Or advertising on the radio, unless you find one of those community spots where they announce things for free.
Okay, go with $65.
If it'll cover the cost of the hourly and the machine,
yeah.
You know, 65, I don't think it's unreasonable.
Okay. Well, we have to put it on the consent agenda.
If you do private enterprise, then does that put you in the area of public advertiser?
It's only for nonprofit.
Pardon? But if you only do nonprofits, I can understand that.
Yeah.
But I don't think we need to be doing anything for commercial.
No.
I think you need to keep it either city or nonprofit, because you get in the rest of it pretty soon. You can add from like the grocery store or something, you got six pages you got to put in there or whatever, and you don't want that. And then we also need to prioritize city,
yes,
city paperwork first.
I think several people would tell me that they're a nonprofit organization.
Yeah, if we open to commercial, if a cabaret moves in, they have a right to use it as much as anybody else. You know, so if you open it up that way, then we have those issues we'll have to deal with in the future. So it'd be nice to keep it just as it is. So
on 5E, since there will be a policy of first come, first serve for review of submittals, city department inserts and submittals will always take precedence over any other submittals, such as the community or police department, whatever, you know, public works, any other type of that information going to citizens. Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie. Okay. Can you want to talk about this one next one still? Did you still want to do the next one, liquor one, or did you want to hold that off for now? I heard you were thinking about it. I didn't know what you were going to do. Okay, it's up to you what you wanted to do. Okay, we'll do the liquor profits and excise tax discussion. Ken.
I think if you've looked at some of that, you might see where I'm coming from with this idea as far as the liquor tax and the some of these initiatives and whatnot are coming out here, 1100, 1105, they're very close together, they parallel each other. There's a little false information in them. They don't specify what effect it's going to do to our city as far as our tax and whatnot. And I think that's where I'm trying to come from. I know I've got some reserves about how this thing works, and you take a person that says, okay, I want to buy a bottle of booze, and I can get it cheaper if the state gets out of it, as far as the liquor, as far as the sales of it. But people don't realize what it actually affects when you do this. Fine, you might save 10% maybe on that bottle or whatever you buy, but who's getting the profit? People like Costco, some of your other areas, they get the profit of it. State don't get that profit anymore, so therefore, everyone, your cities suffer, and your counties suffer, your state suffers from it. I don't know, I this is not exactly what's in here, but it kind of puts in perspective what this is all about. And I thank Amy for putting a lot of this together for me. But here's a, for instance, on the profits of liquor itself, the state gets 50% of that money goes straight to the general fund. The cities get 40% of that, and the county gets 10% of that. That's off of the profit. Okay? Like I got those figures, I can't give them to you right exactly, but somewhere around $31,000 comes off of the tax end of the money, goes straight to Michael Thuttle, a town that size. There's $55,000 that comes out of the profit side, which would be this portion of it, goes directly to the cities, and that's for programs and whatnot that works to help on different things, school programs, and there's other ones. Steve could probably tell better than I can on exactly what happens. But anyway, and then the county gets about 10% of that. Well, that's going to all go away. That'll be gone, because you won't have any profit anymore from those sales. The only thing you'll have is the excise tax, which, and this is what's kind of odd, if you take the 1105 initiative, they said, oh, this won't change. But even that tax will change, because if they drop the price of liquor, therefore your tax also goes down. So that portion won't be as much as what it is at the present time. And those are broke down. The state gets 65% of that, cities get 28% of it, and the counties get 7% of it. So it's going to affect everybody. And people don't realize this, besides you're going to get rid of about 900 jobs, and as far as the state's concerned. So it's a bigger issue than it looks like. Sign an initiative and vote for it, and then you throw it out there, and then what are you going to do with it? So that's all I'm trying to do, is get it out people to realize what happens when you do something like this. You know, if we take $55,000 straight out of our police department and say, no, that don't exist anymore, I mean, that's quite a crunch as far as programs and whatnot. And then say that $31,000 or $35,000, that drops to say $25,000. I mean, that's a $10,000 drop, so that's one of our officers, a portion of his wages. We got to pick that up someplace else. So that's what I'm kind of letting you know what it is. It's kind of up to us and the council if we want to push this issue as far as the city, to get other cities to join in to make it happen. Like Associated Washington Cities, if we can say, hey, this is what is going to affect our little town. What's it going to do to the rest of the communities in their portion of it? Well, that's basically where I'm coming from. I guess it's up to us as far as the council if we want to pursue it, whether it's with a resolution or whether we want to just try to get this information out as an advertisement of what it can actually do to cause more problems, more insult to injury, I guess, what you'd say when it cuts your taxes, you know, your revenue.
Now, I think the Association of Washington Cities is not taking a stand on this?
They're not taking a stand on this issue.
It's sort of confusing, trying to figure out what's going on, I understand, right?
That's right.
Will it do any good to send, to ask them to take a stand on it?
That's one of Ken's goals, is to ask council to jointly either send a resolution adopted by the council or direct the mayor to send a letter asking the Association of Washington Cities, as our lobbyists, to not only lobby the state, but also to support maintaining the liquor profits tax as is to other cities. But currently, I called them last week and Ken and I were talking. They are not going to take a stand on the issue right now.
I think the information stuff's confusing and nobody's sure what's, it's hard to take a stand when you don't really know. You don't know where it's going, so. But it's a little bit confusing what's going on.
Well, that's the whole issue of it. I mean, you hear all this stuff on one side, but you don't get the effects of what it's going to do to you. You know, and most cities and states all got problems tax-wise, so and revenue, so you know it's a big issue.
I think we should do our part to try and educate the other cities and maybe get the Association of Washington Cities on board somehow.
Would it also do any good to send a letter or resolution over to the state or legislatures?
Certainly, you could direct the mayor to do that.
Especially when it cuts so many programs. It's not just the money we get, it's the money that's spread around.
It's going to affect everybody.
Yeah, I would like to take this and go to our other neighboring cities and whatnot and say, hey, we're going to step out and do this. I'll join with the force, and then we can put pressure back on like Washington or Associated Washington Cities, and I think we can get them enough momentum. Nobody's only got till November to get it done. That's the force. After this, once passed by the voters, then you've got a whole different issue you've got to deal with. It goes back to the legislative body, and then they've got to redo this whole thing. And it'd be a big issue is what it would be. But, if you want me to continue to work on it, we can put a resolution together if that's...
For the meeting on the 9th, next week.
Yes. Sounds reasonable to me.
I think so.
Looks like you got the support. Thanks, Ken. Okay. Okay, where are we at here? Ordinance to amend OMC 4.24 entitled Garage Sales. Debbie?
Direction on this ordinance also. What we did was on the proposed ordinance is 4.24 Ultrio, and there's a new section F. And what we proposed was the language to allow nonprofit organizations may have yard sales as long as they meet all of the requirements in the chapter, as long as they hold their yard sale on their privately owned property. Someone today suggested we could add on there or have consent from a property owner to have it on somebody else's property. But it still does not address garage sales in Kiwanis Park or any other parks. So we're just asking for your guys' feedback on changes to the ordinance.
I got a question on, you know, it says that they can have 3 a year. And all that, but how is this, I mean, how is it being enforced? Because I see a couple places where they have a garage sale every weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And there's, who's checking it on Saturday and Sunday, because there's nobody.
Well, you know, you can have up to 3 per year, 3 consecutive days, but code enforcement, you know, stops by those. I don't know if the police department does either. I'm not really sure.
This is one of those issues that are really a complaint-driven type enforcement. If there are complaints, we'll go look into it and take an appropriate action. But it's not monitored very well. You can't, you're right, weekends. Our code enforcement officer does work some weekends, though. But it's a complaint-driven issue. And that's another thing for your consideration. Should we not worry about the 3 permit limit? Or does a perpetual yard sale at your neighbor's house, is that something you don't want to see?
To me, if it's a perpetual yard sale, it's a business.
Yep.
I mean, all of a sudden, they're...
There is a couple of them out there that do use it as a business.
Right.
So we need to know those things before it goes to code enforcement. So the proposed change right now is for the nonprofit organizations to have allow them to have yard sales. One thing that we need to look feedback is garage sales in parks.
Got a little comment on that. You know, we've been doing this for years as far as the nonprofits doing yard sales, you know, Lions and those that I don't know the Rotary anymore, but several different ones have done that for years and years. And I don't see a real problem with it as far as somebody's responsible like most of those organizations. The only thing I think we want to stay away from is having somebody privately go into a park and start having a yard sale. Because you're going to end up with a lot of other issues besides just having a yard sale. When they're done with it, say, oh, the heck with it, and I'll just throw it in the dumpster and I'm done with it. And we're around there cleaning it up. But I think as an organization, like most of your nonprofits, that they're responsible enough that, and we can make it explicit to them that say, okay, when you get done with this, you clean up everything and you're done with it. And I think that we should maintain that and go ahead and let that happen.
And Terry from Public Works did report that they have no problems. And I have to make a correction to my memo. It says this park, but we've been allowing it in Pioneer Park, not Kiwanis Park. But he says that he didn't even know what was going on because they don't have to pick up after the yard sales right now. So I think the nonprofits are really conscious of that.
And I don't think we've seen a nonprofit organization having more than one yard sale a year. Usually it's an annual thing, it's done, they pick it up, you know, they're very, very organized and very conscientious about what they do.
There was a couple weeks ago that was for Remake for Life, and it was up in Pioneer Park. And of course we always tell them that the farmer's market is going on and they have to stay on that side of the park. And there really hasn't been any issues that maybe you know. Has there been any issues with the market?
There's not been an issue with them because they've always been on the west side of the park. Maybe Lions had one there several years ago. I think Rotary's had one there several years ago. And I see no problem with that. I was in and talked to Eamon this morning, and we discussed the other thing would be that let's say Gina and the mayor and myself decided that we don't really have enough for a good yard sale for the each of us. So we want to get together and we'll put it all in one area. And that is restricted by this. We're being asked to come from the residents.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think...
See, and I was going to ask, how does this affect? I know that there's at least one community yard sale that they have, and usually they have it up at Stevens Funeral Home in the parking
yeah.
lot. And it's, like he said, it's something where I think a lot of families can get together, and they don't necessarily have a lot, but they can bring it in and sell it at that time.
Because they're a tenant, they're on the property, they come in and John and Claire come in and they get a yard sale permit for that property. Okay. So there's one yard sale permit that's issued for that family.
So it doesn't matter if several families have a yard sale as long as it's on a property that's
yeah.
the one of the people
okay.
is from.
That was a question. If several people can get together and have one yard sale on one piece of property.
One property.
I see no problem with that. Oh yeah, the Lutherans are going to have another one next week because it rained. They're going to do it outside. They're going to do it outside next week. But anyway.
So is the language about the nonprofits okay? Are you going to do anything different with that? Again, as nonprofit organizations, they have yard sales as long as they meet all of the other requirements in this chapter and as long as they hold a yard sale on their privately owned property.
I don't see a problem with letting them do it in Pioneer Park or Forest Park. Because like we said, we haven't seen problems with them. They're always conscientious and they generally only have them once a year.
Okay, so and add in there that they are allowed to be in parks or are we getting?
The nonprofits.
Yeah. And do we want to allow all four of the parks or just keep it with Pioneer Park?
It would seem like it would be the best location.
I think I think Pioneer Park would be best. Because you get too many other things going on in the other parks. It's just, two people going back and forth and through and around.
It's too big an area, too.
Yeah,
Pioneer Park's central is right there where everybody's driving.
This one works really well.
Yeah. Okay.
Could even put them down Pioneer Park, down Triangle Park. Get something out of that one.
I'll make those changes, and then we'll put it back on the agenda for next meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie. Everybody done with the discussion, right? Okay. Ordinance to amend OMC 12.16.330, entitled Enforcement of Liens. Debbie?
Okay. The governor signed into law ESB 6261, which addresses utility services collections against residential rental properties. In general, the law amends RCW 3521217. By placing new requirements on landlords and city utilities. Due to the changes in the state law, some minor changes are needed to our ordinance relevant to termination of utilities to residential rental residential units. Currently, we are required to provide a written notice to residential or to all units. Right now, our current process is for a 3-day notice. That's what the hanging notice is for a 3-day notice. The changes in the law now requires us to provide written notice to rental residents at least 7 days prior to shutting off the water for non-payment of utilities. So we need to change our ordinance from the 3-day notice to the 7-day notices. Our current code also allows renters to come in and establish a sub-account, and that's okay with the changes in the new law. But if their landlord has become delinquent in order to keep the utilities on, currently we require them to pay a deposit. Now, the new changes in the law says that we need to provide the tenants an opportunity to set up an account with the same terms as anybody else. So we can't require them to pay a deposit if we're not requiring anybody else to pay a deposit. So we have those changes to make in our ordinance. Right now, OMC 1216.330 is the enforcement of the lien, and that's the process of termination. Attached to in your agenda is the ordinance, and on the first page, we just made the change from the 3 days, 3 business days notice for the notice of shutting off to a 7 days, and it's not even business days. The law changed to 7 days. So that's not gonna change a lot with our process either. And we have the opportunity to look at our notice list, determine who's rental properties and who isn't, and give them 7 days notice and the rest of the 3 days. But we've decided in-house it would be probably easier, it will be a lot easier, if we just change the whole ordinance, the whole process to a 7 day notice prior to termination of utilities. So the first page on the ordinance, that's the only change we made, was from the 3 to the 7 day. On section D, we made the change also from the 3 days to the 7 days. We took out the information about setting up a sub-account and the deposit requirements, and added in information that they're given the opportunity to come in, and this is for tenants at a residential rental unit. They're able to come in and set up a sub-account, a new account, or they could pay the utilities, and the law allows them to deduct that from their rental payments, but that's kind of outside of our process, but they're able to do that. And it also just says that if requested, the city shall provide the water, sewer, and garbage services to an affected tenant on the same terms and conditions as other residential utility customers. So we're just making those few minor changes in the ordinance to come in compliance with the new state law. Does that make sense? Okay. And we don't want to split it up and have some people doing 3 and some people doing 7, because we've been dealing with over 100 notices of possible terminations per month. And you know, that takes our staff time and public works time to go out there and hang those notices. It'd be best if we just change the whole process to the 7 days.
Okay. Questions for Denny? Great.
Okay, we'll put this on the next council agenda.
Okay, next is committee reports. We have any reports from any committees? As far as the union committee, we haven't had any meetings. We're still waiting on someone to get back to us on our proposal that we sent in. So as far as that committee, we're standing still waiting, I guess. Any other committees?
Adams County Development Council. We've had some changes lately. Roger Krug is now helping us out. He has taken the lead on any leads and other things with the development. And we also have Grace Shelby now working with us. She is working part-time 3 days a week, I believe.
Monday through Wednesday, yeah.
And it's working out really good so far. We're also having our second annual golf tournament coming up. And me, Ken, and Eamon, I think, has some raffle tickets we need to sell, so you're in and you're interested. We'll get hold of you.
There you go. We have a pool committee report? Or we already heard enough on that, I don't know.
Yeah.
Nope. Okay. Any other committees?
We got
four. Okay.
Solid Waste Advisory Committee. We had a meeting a week ago. Anyway, quite a discussion going on about what's going to happen in the next year. And of course, us as a city of Othello, we need to know what's happening for Adams County. And because we're going to come up with budget time here, what are we going to do? Are we going to have enough revenue to cover what they want to do? I can't give you a total update, but I can give you some thoughts here. What we were looking at as far as the dump fees and whatnot from both the transfer stations, that will remain the same at least through June 2011. They figured they're all right with everything, the way they've got the structure there. It seems like that revenue and expenses were pretty well maintaining that, and it's holding pretty good. The only thing is that grant that they had for a lot of work that they done on the two transfer stations and some support money that we had for different things, that will go away come June of 2011. It may affect things a little bit, but I think they're going to hold pretty close to the line of what they've got now. They were talking about that free one-day dump fee that their dump day that they have out there. That may go away because that was funded through that grant. Another thing that I'd like to bring up and have your thoughts on it, I'll try to get some more information by our next workshop in September, but we're going to have probably some new contracts going out with the garbage hauler contractors, and we'll probably be negotiating those contracts. And I think they're going to, I don't mark my word here, but I think they're going to pretty well hold the line. They might change it a little bit, but if everything looks like what it is, I think we can almost hold the line on what we're doing as far as revenue. The only thing that's going to kind of change things is if we decide we're going to go with recycling and put out different bins for different things. My personal thought and talking to what's going on, I think we ought to put that off for a year or two, maybe longer. I'll tell you why. If we do that, the contractor will automatically raise the cost of our pickup. That money for the recycling portion, Adams County will no longer take care of that. The contractor himself will start his own recycling system, and he'll get the profit from that. So I think it's something we ought to hold for a little while when we start thinking about this. I mean, this is my thought on this. And then that way everything will pretty well stay on a flat level here, and I don't think those prices will go up too much. So it's just something to think about. And I'll try to get some more information by our next workshop, and maybe I'll get somebody here to talk on a little more than what I have here. Yeah. And kind of give you some feedback on this before we get into our budgets and see where we're at. So that's basically what I got.
Thanks, Ken. Any other committee reports? Okay, unfinished business? New business. I have one just so you have information. McCain's went on water over the weekend because of lightning. So they anticipate about 7 days they'll be on water, just so you know. Any other new business? Okay, well, this workshop is adjourned. Thank you for coming, everybody. Okay. Well, you hear Chief's got a good story, don't you?